is what we might call the purpose motive. This is the final big distinction between the two operating systems. Motivation 2.0 centered on profit maximization. Motivation 3.0 doesn't reject profits, but it places equal emphasis on purpose maximization. We see the first stirrings of this new purpose motive in three realms of organizational life: goals, words, and policies. Goals. Boomers aren't singing alone in their chorus of purpose. Joining them and using the same hymn book are their sons and daughters, known as Generation Y, the Millennials, or the Echo Boomers. These young adults, who have recently begun entering the workforce themselves, are shifting the center of gravity in organizations by their very presence. As the writer Sylvia Hewlett has found in her research, the two bookend generations are redefining success and are willing to accept a radically remixed set of rewards. Neither generation rates money as the most important form of compensation. Instead, they choose a range of non-monetary factors, from a great team to the ability to give back to society through work. And if they can't find that satisfying package of rewards in an existing organization, they'll create a venture of their own. Take the case of American Gen Y-er Blake Mikoski and Tom Shoes, the company he launched in 2006. Tom's doesn't fit snugly into the traditional business boxes. It offers hip, canvas, flat-soled shoes, but every time Tom sells a pair of shoes to you, me, or your next-door neighbor, it gives away another pair of shoes to a child in a developing country. Is Tom's a charity that finances its operation with shoe sales? Or is it a business that sacrifices its earnings in order to do good? It's neither. And it's both. The answer is so confusing, in fact, that Tom's Shoes had to address the question directly on its website, just below information on how to return a pair that's too big. Tom's, the site explains, is a for-profit company with giving at its core. Got it? No? Okay, try this. The company's business model transforms our customers into benefactors. Better? Maybe. Weirder? Certainly. Ventures like Tom's blur, perhaps even shatter, the existing categories. Their goals and the way companies reach them are so incompatible to Motivation 2.0 that if Tom's had to rely on this 20th century operating system, the whole endeavor would seize up and crash in the entrepreneurial equivalent of a blue screen of death. Motivation 3.0, by contrast, is expressly built for purpose maximization. In fact, the rise of purpose maximizers is one reason we need the new operating system in the first place. As I explained in Chapter 1, operations like Tom's are on the vanguard of a broader rethinking of how people organize what they do. For-benefit organizations, B corporations, and low-profit limited liability corporations all recast the goals of the traditional business enterprise. And all are becoming more prevalent as a new breed of business person seeks purpose with the fervor that traditional economic theory says entrepreneurs seek profit. Even cooperatives, an older business model with motives other than profit maximization, are moving from the shaggy edge to the clean-cut center. According to writer Marjorie Kelly, in the last three decades, worldwide membership in co-ops has doubled to 800 million people. In the United States alone, more people belong to a co-op than own shares in the stock market. And the idea is spreading. In Colombia, Kelly notes, Salud Co-op provides healthcare services to a quarter of the population. In Spain, the Mondragon Corporación Cooperativa is the nation's seventh largest industrial concern. These not-only-for-profit enterprises are a far cry from the socially responsible businesses that have been all the rage for the last 15 years, but have rarely delivered on their promise. The aims of these Motivation 3.0 companies are not to chase profit while trying to stay ethical and law-abiding. Their goal is to pursue purpose and to use profit as the catalyst rather than the objective. Words. In the spring of 2009, as the world economy was reeling from a once-in-a-generation crisis and the financial shenanigans that stoked it, a few Harvard Business School students glanced in the mirror and wondered if they were the problem. the people they'd aspired to be. Financiers, corporate dealmakers, weren't, it turned out, heroes in an epic tale, but villains in a darker story. Many of these high-profile business people were the ones who pushed the financial system to the brink. Meanwhile, these young men and women looked among their classmates and saw the seeds of similar behavior. In one survey of MBA students a few years earlier, a whopping 56% admitted to cheating regularly. So a handful of Harvard second years, fearing that what was once a badge of honor had become three scarlet letters, did what business students are trained to do. They made a plan. Together they fashioned what they called the MBA Oath, a Hippocratic oath for business grads in which they pledged their fealty to causes above and beyond the bottom line. It's not a legal document, it's a code of conduct. And the conduct it recommends, as well as the very words it uses, leans more toward purpose maximization than profit maximization. From the first sentence, the oath rings with the sounds of Motivation 3.0. As a manager, my purpose is to serve the greater good by bringing people and resources together to create value that no single individual can create alone. It begins. And on it goes for nearly 500 words. I will safeguard the interests of my shareholders, co-workers, customers, and the society in which we operate, the oath takers pledge. I will strive to create sustainable economic, social, and environmental prosperity worldwide. These words, purpose, greater good, sustainable, don't come from the Type X dictionary. One rarely hears them in business school because, after all, that's not what business school is supposed to be about. Yet students at arguably the world's most powerful MBA factory thought otherwise. And in just a few weeks, roughly one quarter of the graduating class had taken the oath and signed the pledge. In launching the effort, Max Anderson, one of the student founders, said, "My hope is that at our 25th reunion, our class will not be known for how much money we made or how much money we gave back to the school, but for how the world was a better place as a result of our leadership." Words matter, and if you listen carefully, you might begin to hear a slightly different, slightly more purpose-oriented dialect. Gary Hamel, who I mentioned earlier, says, "The goals of management are usually described in words like efficiency, advantage, value, superiority, focus, and differentiation. Important as these objectives are, they lack the power to rouse human hearts. Business leaders," he says, "must find ways to infuse mundane business activities with deeper, soul-stirring ideals such as honor, truth, love, justice, and beauty. Humanize what people say, and you may well humanize what they do." That's the thinking behind the simple and effective way Robert B. Reich, former U.S. Labor Secretary, gauges the health of an organization. He calls it the pronoun test. When he visits a workplace, he'll ask the people employed there some questions about the company. He listens to the substance of their response, of course, but most of all, he listens for the pronouns they use. Do the workers refer to the company as they, or do they describe it in terms of we? They companies and we companies, he says, are very different places. And in Motivation 3.0, we wins. Policies. Between the words businesses use and the goals they seek sit the policies they implement to turn the former into the latter. Here, too, one can detect the early tremors of a different approach. For example, many companies in the last decade spent considerable time and effort crafting corporate ethics guidelines. Yet, instances of unethical behavior don't seem to have declined. Valuable though those guidelines can be, as a policy, they can unintentionally move purposeful behavior out of the Type I schema into Type X. As Harvard Business School professor Max Bazerman has explained, say you take people who are motivated to behave nicely, then give them a fairly weak set of ethical standards to meet. Now, instead of asking them to do it because it's the right thing to do, you've essentially given them an alternate set of standards. Do this so you can check off all these boxes. Imagine an organization, for example, that believes in affirmative action, one that wants to make the world a better place by creating a more diverse workforce. By reducing ethics to a checklist, suddenly affirmative action is just a bunch of requirements that the organization must meet to show that it isn't discriminating. Now the organization isn't focused on affirmatively pursuing diversity, but rather on making sure that all the boxes are checked off to show that what it did is okay and so it won't get sued. Before, its workers had an intrinsic motivation to do the right thing, but now they have an extrinsic motivation to make sure the company doesn't get sued or fined. In other words, people might meet the minimal ethical standards to avoid punishment, but the guidelines have done nothing to inject purpose into the corporate bloodstream. The better approach could be to enlist the power of autonomy in the service of purpose maximization. Two intriguing examples demonstrate what I mean. First, many psychologists and economists have found that the correlation between money and happiness is weak, that past a certain and quite modest level, a larger pile of cash doesn't bring people a higher level of satisfaction. But a few social scientists have begun adding a bit more nuance to this observation. According to Lara Aknin and Elizabeth Dunn, sociologists at the University of British Columbia, and Michael Norton, a psychologist at the Harvard Business School, how people spend their money may be at least as important as how much money they earn. In particular, spending money on other people, buying flowers for your spouse rather than an MP3 player for yourself, can actually increase our subjective well-being. So can spending money on a cause, say donating to a religious institution rather than going for an expensive haircut. In fact, Dunn and Norton proposed turning their findings on what they call pro-social spending into corporate policy. According to the Boston Globe, they believe that companies can improve their employees' emotional well-being by shifting some of their budget for charitable giving so that individual employees are given sums to donate, leaving them happier even as the charities of their choice benefit. In other words, handing individual employees control over how the organization gives back to the community might do more to improve their overall satisfaction than one more if-then financial incentive. Another study offers a second possible purpose-centered policy prescription. Physicians in high-profile settings like the Mayo Clinic face pressures and demands that can often lead to burnout. But field research at the prestigious medical facility found that letting doctors spend one day a week on the aspect of their job that was most meaningful to them, whether patient care, research, or community service, could reduce the physical and emotional exhaustion that accompanies their work. Doctors who participated in this trial policy had half the burnout rate of those who did not. Think of it as 20% time with a purpose. The good life. Each year, about 1,300 seniors graduate from the University of Rochester and begin their journey into what many of their parents and professors like to call the real world. Edward Deci, Richard Ryan, and another colleague decided to ask a sample of these soon-to-be graduates about their life goals, and then to follow up with them early in their careers to see how they were doing. While much social science research is done with student volunteers, scientists rarely track students after they've packed up their diplomas and exited the campus gates. And these researchers wanted to study the post-college timeframe because it represents a critical development period that marks people's transitions to their adult identities and lives. Some of the University of Rochester students had what the researchers label extrinsic aspirations. For instance, to become wealthy or to achieve fame, what we might call profit goals. Others had intrinsic aspirations, to help others improve their lives, to learn and to grow, or what we might think of as purpose goals. After these students had been out in the real world for between 1 and 2 years, the researchers tracked them down to see how they were faring. The people who'd had purpose goals and felt they were attaining them reported higher levels of satisfaction and subjective well-being than when they were in college, and quite low levels of anxiety and depression. That's probably no surprise. They'd set a personally meaningful goal and felt they were reaching it. In that situation, most of us would likely feel pretty good too. But the results for people with profit goals were more complicated. Those who said they were attaining their goals, accumulating wealth, winning acclaim, reported levels of satisfaction, self-esteem, and positive affect no higher than when they were students. In other words, they'd reached their goals, but it didn't make them any happier. What's more, graduates with profit goals showed increases in anxiety, depression, and other negative indicators, again, even though they were attaining their goals. These findings are rather striking, the researchers write, as they suggest that attainment of a particular set of goals, in this case profit goals, has no impact on well-being and actually contributes to ill-being. When I discussed these results with DC and Ryan, they were especially emphatic about their significance, because the findings suggest that even when we do get what we want, it's not always what we need. People who are very high in extrinsic goals for wealth are more likely to attain that wealth, but they're still unhappy, Ryan told me. Or, as DC put it, the typical notion is this: you value something, you attain it, then you're better off as a function of it. But what we find is that there are certain things that if you value and if you attain them, you're worse off as a result of it, not better off. Failing to understand this conundrum, that satisfaction depends not merely on having goals, but on having the right goals, can lead sensible people down self-destructive paths. If people chase profit goals, reach those goals, and still don't feel any better about their lives, one response is to increase the size and scope of the goals, to seek more money or greater outside validation. And that can, in the words of Richard Ryan, drive them down a road of further unhappiness, thinking it's the road to happiness. One of the reasons for anxiety and depression in the high attainers is that they're not having good relationships. They're busy making money and attending to themselves, and that means that there's less room in their lives for love and attention and caring and empathy and the things that truly count, Ryan added. And if the broad contours of these findings are true for individuals, why shouldn't they also be true for organizations, which of course are collections of individuals? I don't mean to say that profit doesn't matter. It does. The profit motive has been an important fuel for achievement. But it's not the only motive, and it's not the most important one. Indeed, if we were to look at history's greatest achievements, from the printing press to constitutional democracy to cures for deadly diseases, the spark that kept creators working deep into the night was purpose at least as much as profit. A healthy society and healthy business organizations begins with purpose and considers profit a way to move toward that end or a happy byproduct of its attainment. And here the boomers, maybe, just maybe, can take the lead. On the subjects of autonomy and mastery, adults should look to the eloquent example of children. But perhaps purpose is another matter. Being able to contemplate the big picture, to ponder one's own mortality, to understand the paradox that attaining certain goals isn't the answer, seem to require having spent a few years on the planet. And since the planet very soon will contain more people over age 65 than under age 5 for the first time in its existence, the timing couldn't be better. It is in our nature to seek purpose. But that nature is now being revealed and expressed on a scale that is demographically unprecedented, and until recently, scarcely imaginable. The consequences could rejuvenate our businesses and remake our world. A central idea of this book has been the mismatch between what science knows and what business does. The gap is wide. Its existence is alarming. And though closing it seems daunting, we have reasons to be optimistic. The scientists who study human motivation, several of whom we've encountered in this book, offer us a sharper and more accurate account of both human performance and the human condition. The truths they've revealed are simple, yet powerful. The science shows that those typical 20th century carrot and stick motivators, things we consider somehow a natural part of human enterprise, can sometimes work. But they're effective in only a surprisingly narrow band of circumstances. The science shows that if-then rewards, the mainstays of the Motivation 2.0 operating system, not only are ineffective in many situations, but also can crush the high-level creative conceptual abilities that are central to current and future economic and social progress. The science shows that the secret to high performance isn't our biological drive or our reward and punishment drive, but our third drive, our deep-seated desire to direct our own lives, to extend and expand our abilities, and to live a life of purpose. Bringing our businesses in sync with these truths won't be easy. Unlearning old ideas is difficult, undoing old habits even harder. And I'd be less sanguine about the prospects of closing the motivation gap anytime soon if it weren't for this. The science confirms what we already know in our hearts. We know that human beings are not merely smaller, slower, better-smelling horses galloping after that day's carrot. We know, if we spent time with young children or remember ourselves at our best, that we're not destined to be passive and compliant. We're designed to be active and engaged. And we know that the richest experiences in our lives aren't when we're clamoring for validation from others, but when we're listening to our own voice, doing something that matters, doing it well, and doing it in the service of a cause larger than ourselves. So in the end, repairing the mismatch and bringing our understanding of motivation into the 21st century is more than an essential move for business. It's an affirmation of our humanity. Part 3, The Type I Toolkit. This next section is the Type I Toolkit. It's your guide to taking the ideas in this book and putting them into action. Whether you're looking for a better way to run your organization, navigate your career, or help your kids, there's a tip, a best practice, or a recommended book for you. Also, I'd love to hear your suggestions for what to include in future editions of the Type I Toolkit. Send your ideas directly to me at dhp@danpink.com. Type I for Individuals, 8 Strategies for Awakening Your Motivation. Type I's are made, not born. Although the world is awash in extrinsic motivators, there's a lot we can do to bring more autonomy, mastery, and purpose into our work and life. Here are 8 exercises to get you on the right track. Exercise 1. Give yourself a flow test. Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi did more than discover the concept of flow. He also introduced an ingenious new technique to measure it. Csikszentmihalyi and his University of Chicago team equipped participants in their research studies with electronic pagers. Then they paged people at random intervals, approximately 8 times a day for a week, asking them to describe their mental state at that moment. Compared with previous methods, these real-time reports prove far more honest and revealing. You can use Csikszentmihalyi's methodological innovation in your own quest for mastery by giving yourself a flow test. Set a reminder on your computer or mobile phone to go off at 40 random times in a week. Each time your device beeps, write down what you're doing, how you're feeling, and whether you're in flow. Record your observations, look at the patterns, and consider the following questions. Which moments produced feelings of flow? Where were you? What were you working on? Who were you with? Are certain times of the day more flow-friendly than others? How could you restructure your day based on your findings? How might you increase the number of optimal experiences and reduce the moments when you felt disengaged or distracted? If you're having doubts about your job or career, what does this exercise tell you about your true source of intrinsic motivation? Exercise 2. First, ask a big question. In 1962, Clare Boothe Luce, one of the first women to serve in the U.S. Congress, offered some advice to President John F. Kennedy. "A great man," she told him, "is one sentence." Abraham Lincoln's sentence was, "He preserved the Union and freed the slaves." Franklin Roosevelt's was, "He lifted us out of a Great Depression and helped us win a world war." Luce feared that Kennedy's attention was so splintered among different priorities that his sentence risked becoming a muddled paragraph. You don't have to be a president of the United States or of your local gardening club to learn from this tale. One way to orient your life toward greater purpose is to think about your sentence. Maybe it's, "He raised 4 kids who became healthy and happy adults." or she invented a device that made people's lives easier, or he cared for every person who walked into his office regardless of whether that person could pay, or she taught two generations of children how to read. As you contemplate your purpose, begin with the big question. What's your sentence? Exercise 3. Then keep asking a small question. The big question is necessary but not sufficient. That's where the small question comes in. Real achievement doesn't happen overnight. As anyone who's trained for a marathon, learned a new language, or run a successful division can attest, you spend a lot more time grinding through tough tasks than you do basking in applause. Here's something you can do to keep yourself motivated. At the end of each day, ask yourself whether you were better today than you were yesterday. Did you do more? Did you do it well? Or to get specific, did you learn your 10 vocabulary words, make your 8 sales calls, eat your 5 servings of fruits and vegetables, write your 4 pages? You don't have to be flawless each day. Instead, look for small measures of improvement, such as how long you practice your saxophone, or whether you held off checking email until you finished that report you needed to write. Reminding yourself that you don't need to be a master by day 3 is the best way of ensuring you will be one by day 3,000. So before you go to sleep each night, ask yourself the small question. Was I better today than yesterday? Exercise 4. Take a Sagmeister. The designer Stefan Sagmeister has found a brilliant way to ensure he's living a type I life. Think about the standard pattern in developed countries, he says. People usually spend the first 25 or so years of their lives learning, the next 40 or so years working, and the final 25 in retirement. That boilerplate timeline got Sagmeister wondering. Why not snip 5 years from retirement and sprinkle them into your working years? So every 7 years, Sagmeister closes his graphic design shop, tells his clients he won't be back for a year, and goes off on a 365-day sabbatical. He uses the time to travel, to live places he's never been, and to experiment with new projects. It sounds risky, I know, but he says the ideas he generates during the year off often provide his income for the next 7 years. Taking a Sagmeister, as I now call it, requires a fair bit of planning and saving, of course. But doesn't foregoing that big-screen TV seem a small price to pay for an unforgettable and unget-backable year of personal exploration? The truth is, this idea is more realistic than many of us realize, which is why I hope to take a Sagmeister in a couple of years, and why you should consider it too. Exercise 5. Give yourself a performance review. Performance reviews, those annual or biannual rituals of organizational life, are about as enjoyable as a toothache and as productive as a train wreck. Nobody likes them, not the giver, not the receiver. They don't really help us achieve mastery, since feedback often comes 6 months after the work is complete. Imagine Serena Williams or Twyla Tharp seeing their results or reading reviews only twice a year. And yet managers keep on hauling employees into their offices for those awkward, painful encounters. Maybe there's a better way. Maybe, as Douglas McGregor and others have suggested, we should give ourselves our own performance reviews. Here's how. Figure out your goals, mostly learning goals, but a few performance goals, and then every month, call yourself to your office and give yourself an appraisal. How are you faring? Where are you falling short? What tools, information, or support might you need to do better? Some other hints. Set both smaller and larger goals so that when it comes time to evaluate yourself, you've already accomplished some whole tasks. Make sure you understand how every aspect of your work relates to your larger purpose. Be brutally honest. This exercise is aimed at helping you improve performance and achieve mastery. So if you rationalize failures or gloss over your mistakes instead of learning from them, you're wasting your time. And if doing this solo isn't your thing, gather a small group of colleagues for regular peer-based do-it-yourself performance reviews. If your comrades really care, they'll tell you the truth and hold you accountable. One last question for bosses. Why in God's name are you not encouraging all your employees to do this? Exercise 6. Get unstuck by going oblique. Even the most intrinsically motivated person sometimes gets stuck. So here's a simple, easy, and fun way to power out of your mental morass. In 1975, producer Brian Eno and artist Peter Schmidt published a set of 100 cards containing strategies that help them overcome the pressure-packed moments that always accompany a deadline. Each card contains a single, often inscrutable question or statement to push you out of a mental rut. Some examples. What would your closest friend do? Your mistake was a hidden intention. What is the simplest solution? Repetition is a form of change. Don't avoid what is easy. If you're working on a project and find yourself stymied, pull an oblique card from the deck. These brain bombs are a great way to keep your mind open despite constraints you can't control. You can buy the deck at www.enoshop.co.uk or follow one of the Twitter accounts inspired by the strategies, such as twitter.com/oblique_chirps. Exercise 7. Move 5 steps closer to mastery. One key to mastery is what Florida State University psychology professor Anders Ericsson calls deliberate practice, a lifelong period of effort to improve performance in a specific domain. Deliberate practice isn't running a few miles each day or banging on the piano for 20 minutes each morning. It's much more purposeful, focused, and yes, painful. Follow these steps over and over again for a decade, and you just might become a master. Step 1. Remember that deliberate practice has one objective, to improve performance. People who play tennis once a week for years don't get any better if they do the same thing each time, Ericsson has said. Deliberate practice is about changing your performance, setting new goals, and straining yourself to reach a bit higher each time. Step 2. Repeat, repeat, repeat. Repetition matters. Basketball greats don't shoot 10 free throws at the end of team practice. They shoot 500. Step 3. Seek constant, critical feedback. If you don't know how you're doing, you won't know what to improve. Step 4. Focus ruthlessly on where you need help. While many of us work on what we're already good at, says Ericsson, those who get better work on their weaknesses. Step 5. Prepare for the process to be mentally and physically exhausting. That's why so few people commit to it, but that's why it works. Exercise 8. Take a page from Weber and a card from your pocket. In his insightful book, Rules of Thumb, Fast Company magazine co-founder Alan Weber offers a smart and simple exercise for assessing whether you're on the path to autonomy, mastery, and purpose. Get a few blank 3x5-inch cards. On one of the cards, write your answer to this question. What gets you up in the morning? Now, on the other side of the card, write your answer to another question. What keeps you up at night? Pair each response to a single sentence. And if you don't like an answer, toss the card and try again until you've crafted something you can live with. Then read what you've produced. If both answers give you a sense of meaning and direction, congratulations, says Weber. Use them as a compass, checking from time to time to see if they're still true. If you don't like one or both of your answers, it opens up a new question. What are you going to do about it? Type I for organizations. 9 ways to improve your company, office, or group. Whether you're the CEO or the new intern, you can help create engaging, productive workplaces that foster Type I behavior. Here are 9 ways to begin pulling your organization out of the past and into the brighter world of Motivation 3.0. Exercise 1. Try 20% time with training wheels. You've heard about the wonders of 20% time, where organizations encourage employees to spend 1/5 of their hours working on any project they want. And if you've ever used Gmail or read Google News, you've benefited from the results. But for all the virtues of this Type I innovation, Putting such a policy in place can seem daunting. How much will it cost? What if it doesn't work? If you're feeling skittish, here's an idea. Go with a more modest version, 20% time, with training wheels. Start with, say, 10% time. That's just one afternoon of a 5-day work week. Who among us hasn't wasted that amount of time at work anyway? And instead of committing to it forever, try it for 6 months. By creating this island of autonomy, you'll help people act on their great ideas and convert their downtime into more productive time. And who knows? Someone in your operation just might invent the next post-it note. Exercise 2. Encourage peer-to-peer, now that rewards. Kimley Horn and Associates, a civil engineering firm in Raleigh, North Carolina, has established a reward system that gets the Type I stamp of approval. At any point, without asking permission, anyone in the company can award a $50 bonus to any of her colleagues. It works because it's real time and it's not handed down from any management, the firm's human resources director told Fast Company. Any employee who does something exceptional receives recognition from their peers within minutes. Because these bonuses are non-contingent now that rewards, they avoid the 7 deadly flaws of most corporate carrots. And because they come from a colleague, not a boss, they carry a different and perhaps deeper meaning. You could even say they're motivating. Exercise 3. Conduct an autonomy audit. How much autonomy do the people in your organization really have? If you're like most folks, you probably don't have a clue. Nobody does. But there's a way to find out, with an autonomy audit. Ask everyone in your department or on your team to respond to these 4 questions with the numerical ranking, using a scale of 0 to 10, with 0 meaning almost none, and 10 meaning a huge amount. 1. How much autonomy do you have over your tasks at work, your main responsibilities and what you do in a given day? 2. How much autonomy do you have over your time at work? For instance, when you arrive, when you leave, and how you allocate your hours each day. 3. How much autonomy do you have over your team at work? That is, to what extent are you able to choose the people with whom you typically collaborate? 4. How much autonomy do you have over your technique at work? How you actually perform the main responsibilities of your job? Make sure all the responses are anonymous. Then tabulate the results. What's the employee average? The figure will fall somewhere on a 40-point autonomy scale, with 0 being a North Korean prison and 40 being Woodstock. Compare that number to people's perceptions. Perhaps the boss thought everyone had plenty of freedom, but the audit showed an average autonomy rating of only 15. Also calculate separate results for task, time, team, and technique. A healthy overall average can sometimes mask a problem in a particular area. An overall autonomy rating of, say, 27 isn't bad. However, if that average consists of 8 each for task, technique, and team, but only 3 for time, you've identified an autonomy weak spot in the organization. It's remarkable sometimes how little the people running organizations know about the experiences of the people working around them. But it's equally remarkable how often leaders are willing to do things differently if they see real data. That's what an autonomy audit can do. And if you include a section in your audit for employees to jot down their own ideas about increasing autonomy, you might even find some great solutions. Exercise 4. Take 3 steps toward giving up control. Type X bosses relish control. Type I bosses relinquish control. Extending people the freedom they need to do great work is usually wise, but it's not always easy. So if you're feeling the urge to control, here are 3 ways to begin letting go, for your own benefit and your team's. 1. Involve people in goal setting. Would you rather set your own goals or have them foisted upon you? Thought so. Why should those working with you be any different? A considerable body of research shows that individuals are far more engaged when they're pursuing goals they had a hand in creating. So bring employees into the process. They could surprise you. people often have higher aims than the ones you assign them. 2. Use non-controlling language. Next time you're about to say must or should, try saying think about or consider instead. A small change in wording can help promote engagement over compliance and might even reduce some people's urge to defy. Think about it, or at least consider it, okay? 3. Hold office hours. Sometimes you need to summon people into your office, but sometimes it's wise to let them come to you. Take a cue from college professors and set aside 1 or 2 hours a week when your schedule is clear and any employee can come in and talk to you about anything that's on her mind. Your colleagues might benefit, and you might learn something. Exercise 5. Play Whose Purpose Is It Anyway? This is another exercise designed to close the gap between perception and reality. Gather your team, your department, or, if you can, all the employees in your outfit. Hand everyone a blank 3x5-inch card. Then ask each person to write down his or her one-sentence answer to the following question. What is our company's or our organization's purpose? Collect the cards and read them aloud. What do they tell you? Are the answers similar, everyone aligned along a common purpose? Or are they all over the place? Some people believing one thing, others something completely different, and still others without even a guess. For all the talk about culture, alignment, and mission, most organizations do a pretty shabby job of assessing this aspect of their business. This simple inquiry can offer a glimpse into the soul of your enterprise. If people don't know why they're doing what they're doing, how can you expect them to be motivated to do it? Exercise 6. Use Reich's Pronoun Test. Former U.S. Labor Secretary Robert B. Reich has devised a smart, simple, and free diagnostic tool for measuring the health of an organization. When he talks to employees, he listens carefully for the pronouns they use. Do employees refer to their company as they or as we? They suggest at least some amount of disengagement and perhaps even alienation. We suggest the opposite, that employees feel they're part of something significant and meaningful. If you're a boss, spend a few days listening to the people around you, not only in formal settings like meetings, but in the hallways and at lunch as well. Are you a we organization or a they organization? The difference matters. Everybody wants autonomy, mastery, and purpose. The thing is, we can get it, but they can't. Exercise 7. Design for Intrinsic Motivation. Internet guru and author Clay Shirky says that the most successful websites and electronic forums have a certain type I approach in their DNA. They're designed, often explicitly, to tap intrinsic motivation. You can do the same with your online presence if you listen to Shirky and create an environment that makes people feel good about participating. Give users autonomy. Keep the system as open as possible. And what matters in cyberspace matters equally in physical space. Ask yourself, how does the built environment of your workplace promote or inhibit autonomy, mastery, and purpose? Exercise 8. Promote Goldilocks for groups. Almost everyone has experienced the satisfaction of a Goldilocks task, the kind that's neither too easy nor too hard, that delivers a delicious sense of flow. But sometimes it's difficult to replicate that experience when you're working in a team. People often end up doing the jobs they always do because they've proven they can do them well, and an unfortunate few get saddled with the flow-free tasks nobody else wants. Here are a few ways to bring a little Goldilocks to your group. 1. Begin with a diverse team. As Harvard's Teresa Amabile advises, set up work groups so that people will stimulate each other and learn from each other so that they're not homogeneous in terms of their backgrounds and training. You want people who can really cross-fertilize each other's ideas. 2. Make your group a no-competition zone. Pitting coworkers against one another in the hope that competition will spark them to perform better rarely works and almost always undermines intrinsic motivation. If you're going to use a C word, go with collaboration or cooperation. 3. Try a little task shifting. If someone is bored with his current assignment, see if he can train someone else in the skills he's already mastered. Then see if he can take on some aspect of a more experienced team member's work. 4. Animate with purpose. Don't motivate with rewards. Nothing bonds a team like a shared mission. The more that people share a common cause, whether it's creating something insanely great, outperforming an outside competitor, or even changing the world, the more your group will do deeply satisfying and outstanding work. Exercise 9. Turn your next offsite into a FedEx day. Behold the company offsite, a few spirit-sapping days of forced fun and manufactured morale featuring awkward pep talks, wretched dancing, and a few trust falls. To be fair, some offsites re-engage employees, recharge people's batteries, and restart conversations on big issues. But if your organization's offsites are falling short, why not try replacing the next one with a FedEx day? Set aside an entire day where employees can work on anything they choose, however they want, with whomever they'd like. Make sure they have the tools and resources they need. And impose just one rule. People must deliver something. A new idea, a prototype of a product, a better internal process, the following day. Type I organizations know what their Type X counterparts rarely comprehend. Real challenges are far more invigorating than controlled leisure. The Zen of Compensation. Paying people the Type I way. Everybody wants to be paid well. I sure do. I bet you're the same. The Type I approach to motivation doesn't require bargain basement wages or an all-volunteer workforce, but it does demand a new approach to pay. Think of this new approach as the Zen of Compensation. In Motivation 3.0, the best use of money is to take the issue of money off the table. The more prominent salary, perks, and benefits are in someone's work life, the more they can inhibit creativity and unravel performance. As Edward Deci explained in Chapter 3, when organizations use rewards like money to motivate staff, that's when they're most demotivating. The better strategy is to get compensation right and then get it out of sight. Effective organizations compensate people in amounts and in ways that allow individuals to mostly forget about compensation and instead focus on the work itself. Here are 3 key techniques. 1. Ensure internal and external fairness. The most important aspect of any compensation package is fairness. And here, fairness comes in 2 varieties, internal and external. Internal fairness means paying people commensurate with their colleagues. External fairness means paying people in line with others doing similar work in similar organizations. Let's look at each type of fairness. Suppose you and Fred have adjoining cubicles, and suppose you've got pretty much equivalent responsibility and experience. If Fred makes scads more money than you, you'll be miffed. Because of this violation of internal fairness, your motivation will plummet. Now suppose instead that you and Fred are both auditors with 10 years' experience working in a Fortune 200 company. If you discover that auditors with similar experience at other Fortune 200 firms are making double your salaries, both you and Fred will experience a largely irreversible motivation dip. The company has violated the ethic of external fairness. One important addendum. Paying people the Type I way doesn't mean paying everyone the same amount. If Fred has a harder job or contributes more to the organization than you, he deserves a richer deal. And as it turns out, several studies have shown that most people don't have a beef with that. Why? It's fair. Getting the internal and external equity right isn't itself a motivator, but it's a way to avoid putting the issue of money back on the table and making it a demotivator. 2. Pay more than average. If you have provided adequate baseline rewards and established internal and external fairness, consider borrowing a strategy first surfaced by a Nobel laureate. In the mid-1980s, George Ekerlof, who later won the Nobel Prize in Economics, and his wife, Janet Yellen, who's also an economist, discovered that some companies seem to be overpaying their workers. Instead of paying employees the wages that supply and demand would have predicted, they gave their workers a little more. It wasn't because the companies were selfless, and it wasn't because they were stupid. It was because they were savvy. Paying great people more than the market demands, these economists found, could attract better talent, reduce turnover, and boost productivity and morale. Higher wages could actually reduce a company's costs. The pay more than average approach can offer an elegant way to bypass if-then rewards, eliminate concerns about unfairness, and help take the issue of money off the table. It's another way to allow people to focus on the work itself. Indeed, other economists have shown that providing an employee a high level of base pay does more to boost performance and organizational commitment than an attractive bonus structure. Of course, by the very nature of the exercise, paying above average will work for only about half of you. So get going before your competitors do. 3. If you use performance metrics, make them wide-ranging, relevant, and hard to game. Imagine you're a product manager and your pay depends largely on reaching a particular sales goal for the next quarter. If you're smart, or if you've got a family to feed, you're going to try mightily to hit that number. You probably won't concern yourself much with the quarter after that or the health of the company or whether the firm is investing enough in research and development. And if you're nervous, you might cut corners to reach your quarterly goal. Now imagine you're a product manager and your pay is determined by these factors: your sales for the next quarter, your sales in the current year, the company's revenue and profit in the next 2 years, levels of satisfaction among your customers, ideas for new products, and evaluations of your coworkers. If you're smart, you'll probably try to sell your product, serve your customers, help your teammates, and, well, do good work. When metrics are varied, they're harder to finagle. In addition, the gain for reaching the metrics shouldn't be too large. When the payoff for reaching targets is modest rather than massive, it's less likely to narrow people's focus or encourage them to take the low road. To be sure, finding the right mix of metrics is difficult and will vary considerably across organizations. And some people will inevitably find a way to game even the most carefully calibrated system. But using a variety of measures that reflect the totality of great work can transform often counterproductive if-then rewards into less combustible now-that rewards. Type I for parents and educators. 9 ideas for helping our kids. All kids start out as curious, self-directed type I's, but many of them end up as disengaged, compliant type X's. What's going on? Maybe the problem is us, the adults who are running schools and heading families. If we want to equip young people for the new world of work, and more important, if we want them to lead satisfying lives, we need to break Motivation 2.0's grip on education and parenting. Unfortunately, as with business, there's a mismatch between what science knows and what schools do. Science knows, and you do too if you listen to Chapter 2, that if you promise a preschooler a fancy certificate for drawing a picture, that child will likely draw a picture for you and then lose further interest in drawing. Yet in the face of this evidence, and as the world economy demands more non-routine, creative, conceptual abilities, too many schools are moving in the wrong direction. They're redoubling their emphasis on routines, right answers, and standardization. And they're hauling out a wagon full of if-then rewards. Pizza for reading books, iPods for showing up to class, cash for good test scores. We're bribing students into compliance instead of challenging them into engagement. We can do better, and we should. If we want to raise Type I kids at school and at home, we need to help move them toward autonomy, mastery, and purpose. Here are 9 ways to start the journey. 1. Apply the 3-part Type I test for homework. Does the homework bulging from kids' backpacks truly help them learn? Or does it simply steal their free time in the service of a false sense of rigor? Teachers, before you dole out yet another time-consuming assignment, run it through this Type I homework test by asking yourself three questions. 1. Am I offering students any autonomy over how and when to do this work? 2. Does this assignment promote mastery by offering a novel, engaging task, as opposed to rote reformulation of something already covered in class? 3. Do my students understand the purpose of this assignment? That is, can they see how doing this additional activity at home contributes to the larger enterprise in which the class is engaged? If the answer to any of these questions is no, can you refashion the assignment? And parents, are you looking at homework assignments every so often to see whether they promote compliance or engagement? Let's not waste our kids' time on meaningless exercises. With a little thought and effort, we can turn homework into home learning. 2. Have a FedEx day. In Chapter 4, we learned how the software company Atlassian injects a burst of autonomy into its workplace by setting aside a day each quarter when employees can work on any project they choose, however they want, with whomever they'd like. Why not try this with your students, or even your own sons and daughters? Set aside an entire school day, or a family vacation day, and ask kids to come up with a problem to solve or a project to tackle. In advance, help them collect the tools, information, and supplies they might need. Then let them have at it. The next morning, ask them to deliver by reporting back to the class or the family on their discoveries and experiences. It's like Project Runway. Only the kids come up with the projects themselves, and the reward at the end of the day is the chance to share what they've created and all they've learned along the way. 3. Try DIY report cards. Too many students walk through the schoolhouse door with one aim in mind: to get good grades. And all too often, the best way to reach this goal is to get with the program, avoid risks, and serve up the answers the teacher wants the way the teacher wants them. Good grades become a reward for compliance, but don't have much to do with learning. Meanwhile, students whose grades don't measure up often see themselves as failures and give up trying to learn. The Type I approach is different. Report cards are not a potential prize, but a way to offer students useful feedback on their progress. And Type I students understand that a great way to get feedback is to evaluate their own progress. So try experimenting with the DIY or do-it-yourself report card. At the beginning of a semester, ask students to list their top learning goals. Then, at the end of the semester, ask them to create their own report card along with a one- or two-paragraph review of their progress. Where did they succeed? Where did they fall short? What more do they need to learn? Once students have completed their DIY report cards, show them the teacher's report card and let the comparison of the two be the start of a conversation on how they are doing on their path toward mastery. Maybe even include students in any parent-teacher conferences. Parents, if your child's teacher won't go for these DIY report cards, try it yourself at home. It's another way to prevent school from changing your child's default setting and turning him from Type I to Type X. 4. Give your kids an allowance and some chores, but don't combine them. Here's why an allowance is good for kids. Having a little of their own money and deciding how to save or spend it offers a measure of autonomy and teaches them to be responsible with cash. Here's why household chores are good for kids. Chores show kids